SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, in association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, is pleased to present another in the SNI Digital series on controversies in spine surgery, three 40-minute lectures with discussion. They're given on the topic of pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery by Nancy Epstein. Nancy is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York at Stony Brook and the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. She's been in the practice of spine surgery for 40 years. And has a bibliography that's one of the most extensive in the field. A series of lectures on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior spine, cervical spine surgery are focused on how to choose the correct approaches to lesions in the cervical spine with attention to the K-line. Part one is on the anatomy, imaging, clinical presentations, of cervical spine neurologic disease and one-level ACDF, 40 minutes. Part two is on approach to two-level or more anterior cervical spine lesions, also 40 minutes. And part three is on approaches to posterior cervical spine lesions, also 40 minutes. His first lecture in Pearls and Pitfalls of Anterior and Posterior Cervical Spine Surgery is on the anatomy, imaging, clinical presentations of cervical spine neurological disease and one-level ACDF. The lecture and discussion is 40 minutes.
Whenever you start thinking anterior, posterior, you really start to try and figure out how do you make these decisions. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to start with basically, you know, showing you anterior discectomy infusions and then showing you what's called the K-line to discern whether or not you go from the front or the back and what criteria you use to do this. I'm going to look at the cervical anatomy, MR and CT studies. We're going to discuss briefly cervical radiculopathy and myelopathy, anterior discectomy infusions, anterior corpectomy infusions, and then posterior surgical procedures. Just as a quick reminder of the cervical spine anatomy, and we have other talks that go over this in greater detail. Obviously, on a cross-section view, you have the anterior vertebral body. This is followed by the circumferential epidural space that's shown here in blue. Next, you have the spinal cord. It's sitting in a bath of spinal fluid, obviously, dura, arachnoid, pia, you know, around that. And then you have the posterior aspect of the epidural space going circumferentially. And then posterior, you have the lamina, and then ultimately your spinous processes. When I was going over this and I decided I'm going to also emphasize the anatomy, the anterior cord, the posterior cord, I thought it would be a great opportunity to tell everybody again or remind them when you were doing these operations, intraoperative neural monitoring, I don't care what the quote standard of care is officially, you know, you have to just stop and think. If you have an adjunct that can make your operations safer for that patient, why wouldn't you want to use intraoperative neural monitoring? And again, if you use the monitoring, you have to understand it and you have to adjust your surgery according to any changes that may occur. Now, in terms of anatomy, the anterior cord, the alpha motor neurons, motor evoked potentials, that's going to subserve. Posteriorly, you have the posterior column, somatosensory evoked potentials. And then obviously, but bilaterally, you're going to have the nerve roots, and that's why you're going to perform EMG or electromyography. When you're talking about looking at motor evoked potentials, you know, anterior spinothalamic tract, but more so motor neurons, patients who have severe preoperative motor deficits, sometimes these MEPs are absent to start with and they recur or appear during the operation itself. You certainly don't want the opposite, where MEPs are there and they drop out. Don't ignore them. Don't just continue doing what you're doing. I've had a case recently where they were completely ignored. A surgeon continued doing the wrong operation, and the patient ended up with paraplegia. Somatosensory evoked potentials, obviously, it's monitoring the posterior columns. Vibration and position appreciation may be the deficits that you see preoperatively. If you get SEP changes and you're doing an anterior operation and you're not doing motor evoked potentials, you're actually causing a lot of damage in order to get those SEP changes to occur. And obviously, then you have the nerve roots, the EMG for the anterior motor root. And in the cervical spine, that's usually the little white root that sometimes is not enclosed in the dura, that sometimes you can miss or misinterpret as your disc and take out inadvertently. And obviously, you have the posterior sensory nerve root. What are the differences between MRs and CAT scans? This is always very helpful to remind patients, not necessarily physicians. But everybody needs a good reminder some of the time. And basically, if you understand what an M&M is, our international colleagues may not. It's chocolate inside what's called a hard candy shell. And what I would say is that the chocolate on the inside is like the soft tissue on an MR. It can be the nerve tissue. It can be the spinal fluid. It can be the cerebrospinal fluid. It can be the fat. It can be a blood clot, et cetera. The hard candy shell on the outside is the calcification or the ossification. Again, your MRs are going to underestimate the extent of stenosis because they do not, quote, see bone. Bone appears to be hypointense. CAT scan is going to give you a direct image that's going to be hyperdense and document the presence of bone. Next, you have to really understand or remember, is there cervical stenosis here or not? What is cervical stenosis? It means a narrowing of the front to back dimension of the spinal canal. Sometimes it's just off to the sides as well. But here is the normal 17 millimeter canal measured from the mid aspect of the vertebral body to the posterior laminar line. Posterior laminar line, again, if you look at my hands and my arms are the lamina, my hands are the spinous processes. It's where the spinous processes take off. And then here on a lateral view showing figuratively, and I'm going to show you in a minute, X-rays and CAT scans and MRs, normal canal is 17 millimeters. Something called relative stenosis is usually between 10 to 13 millimeters, and congenital stenosis, the kind you're born with, obviously, is less than 10 millimeters. By the way, the minimal dimension of the spinal cord is 8 millimeters to 13 millimeters on an AP image. 2 to 3 millimeters of that is taken up with the soft tissues like ligaments, like fat, like the epidural vessels. So you have to pay attention to this in terms of making your, judgments. Here is your lateral cervical film, or here's your AP view first. Here's your lateral view going from the mid aspect of the vertebral body to the posterior interlaminar line. The dimensions of your canal are going to be different at different levels. The higher you are, C1-2, very wide, C2-3, also very wide, and it gets typically narrower as you go down, C4-5, 5-6, and 6-7. So here you can see this is going to be very narrow opposite C2, but C3, C4, C5, C6, and C7. That's just on an X-ray view. Typically, this is a 6-foot X-ray. My uncle was a neuroradiologist, and as a 15-year-old in his lab and office and in front of all of his crew, he would say, "Okay, Nancy, tell me about what kind of a cervical X-ray you're going to obtain." And I'd have to say, "Oh, Bernie, it's a 6-foot film, and you're going to do it perfectly, and you're never going to forget this because if I do, I'm going to be dead." Here is your classical MR scan that's going to nicely show you these are the vertebral bodies. You are not seeing the body; you're actually seeing the fat in the bone, you're seeing the water component in the bone, but you're not actually seeing the bone itself. Here you're seeing the spinal fluid. That's why they call this the myelographic view. Here's your spinal cord coming down, and posteriorly here is your CSF as well. And then your spinous processes is what you're viewing posteriorly. Now, just to jump into pathology, here is a figurative diagram and then an actual MR. It's an axial image of a right C6-7 disc. Here is the spinal canal right here. This is your anterolateral disc in this case, right-sided, because we just used the body imaging people call this is the right and this is the left. Here's an actual MR from a patient. Okay, and here's the anterior and posterior, and here is your soft disc herniation seen here. Okay, here, by the way, is your spinal cord, and CSF is around your cord on this image. Here is an MR, once again, of a normal cervical canal, midline sagittal view. Cord is coming down unimpeded, CSF all around it. Again, your myelographic view, normal size spinal canal seen on that study. Good lordosis, by the way, that's the normal curvature of the cervical spine. Here is an MRI scan. Look at the C2-3 level. Cord is not compressed. C3-4, it becomes somewhat narrowed. And look what's happening here then. It's C4, 5, 6, and 7, markedly narrowed AP diameter of the canal. And look, the lordosis is straightened. And we'll talk later about how you make a decision, anterior, posterior, in terms of which direction you do the surgery from, if there is a straightening of the lordosis. And I'm also going to point out to you that you saw the increased signal in the cord. So again, that is something you're going to pick up on an MR, and you're not going to see that on a CT. You do not see cord detail on the CT scans. This is what you're going to see on a CT. Here's your lateral view. Okay, C2, C3, 4, 5, and 6. And here, C2, again, the widest level. 3, 4, 5, and 6, mid body to posterior interlaminar line. This is an actual CT scan. So the beauty of a CAT scan is you can directly measure from the bone, especially on the 2D, non-contrast study. You can actually see the bone that you're directly measuring from. And this is going to be more accurate in terms of measuring your canal dimensions than what you're going to get on an MR. And again, as I'm emphasizing, you're going to be able to document stenosis better on the CT than the MR, but you're not going to see the degree of cord compression, nerve root compression, and that other detail unless you have that MRI. Non-contrast CAT scan, a figurative diagram of a ventral spur at C5-6, seen here. And then here is the actual non-contrast CT itself. Everything from here posteriorly, that is all calcified spur. And again, on the MR, you're going to see the detail is how much cord compression there may be accompanying that image. Now, a myelogram CAT scan is kind of like the Cadillac of how you document whether there's spinal cord or nerve compression. Myelogram CAT scans are extremely useful, especially in patients who've had previous spinal instrumentation. It might be the best way to get the actual images as to what's going on. But here's your myelogram CAT scan. It's a two-dimensional study. And here is your spinal cord. C2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Look at the bony spurs. All of that bony detail you're not going to see like that on an MR. But again, here, your cord on that mid-sagittal image looks to be free. Here's a central left-sided disc on an axial study, anterolateral disc herniation here, C7T1. Again, a difficult level sometimes in view of large shoulders to visualize on a non-contrast CT, much less even an MRI. And for looking at OPLL, it's a great study. You have to watch out, though. If there's a lot of cord compression, you may just want to get your non-contrast CT and not risk that patient's neurological deterioration. But just to keep in mind, MR, soft tissues, CAT scan, bone information. And if you're doing a cervical complex procedure, the two studies together are going to show you more information than just one alone. A very famous colleague of mine named Jim Ausman sent me this image the other day and said, "I need a reminder about the neuroanatomy of the cervical spine." So as you may recall, C1 goes over and above the arch of C1. At all of the other levels, let's say it's C2-3, take the lower number of that level, and that's the nerve root that you're going to be dealing with. So C2-3, it's the C3 root, and so on down until you get, to C8-T1, which is going to be your C8 nerve root. What do these deficits result in? It results in radiculopathy or root symptoms and signs. At the C4-5 level with the C5 root coming down, that patient may have deltoid weakness. So you ask them to hold their arm out to the side, push their arm down. By the way, if you're doing a telemedicine evaluation. You can have the patient do this to themselves, or you can have a relative sitting there doing it with them. And it's amazing how accurate some of these evaluations can be if you can't just, see the patient in person. C6 nerve root, you've got weakness of the biceps. You say, try and pull your arm down or push your own arm down and see if you can resist that. And for the wrist, hold your wrist out straight and then see if you can forcibly bend the wrist or take the thumb and index finger and come through the thumb and index finger or not. So that may show you whether you have a C6 root deficit. And C7 is basically, can you come through the thumb and pinky? Extensor of the phalanges is very, very C7. And the triceps is, sort of a combination of C7, but a little bit of other. So these are just the nerve roots that, you just want to remember their location. Again, if you remember nothing else, at any level, just take the lower number, and that's going to be the root that's going to be involved. Cervical myelopathy means that there is some degree of cord compression. And this is obviously a post-mortem evaluation of a disc herniation and the cord being compressed. And here's a myelogram CAT scan of a soft ventral disc, and the cord is deformed anteriorly on this image. What are the deficits that you're going to see? Weakness of one or both sides, upper extremity, lower extremity, entire arm or leg, or both. Reflexes can be hyperactive. You've got Hoffman signs. You may have Babinski responses. And sensory loss could be pain and temperature from a specific level down, like a pin level. I saw a gentleman with a thoracic disc the other day, and indeed he could tell it was a pin at approximately the lesion was about T89. He could tell the difference between the sharp pin and just sort of a dull sensation on the left side, as opposed to the right side where the pin was clearly a pin. So sometimes this is more subtle, and you have to examine this very, very carefully. Vibration and position is sort of self-evident. You can ask them about loss of urinary or bowel dysfunction. Do yourself a favor, and some of these patients, just get yourself an ultrasound, especially if it's in an emergency room. There was a case where we were discussing a patient, and very clearly the patient had not voided all day, and the ultrasound certainly of the bladder documented that. Anterior cervical discectomies, because now we're going to switch into a discussion of surgery. Anterior discectomy infusions, single or multi-level, one of the most common operations in the US, about 137 of these thousand per year. And here you have your classic, you have your MR. It may or may not be supplemented with a CT of your disc herniation. It's followed by, you're going to do your discectomy, you're going to place a graft, and we'll talk about different grafts that can be used. And this is then going to be followed by two-dimensional CAT scan that might be done 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months later. And obviously, your lateral cervical X-rays that may be done immediately post-op, intra-op, and post-op, and then, 6 weeks, 3 months, et cetera, with flexion extension X-rays subsequently being performed. And that's your, plate with your screws, superiorly and inferiorly, et cetera.
Could you go back to that a minute, Nancy?
Yeah.
Well, how long does it take for you to see fusion of, let's say, a bony graft?
It really takes 3 months.
3 months.
People can say, oh, yeah. I mean, I've had some, cases that I've reviewed that say, oh, it's fused, it's 6 weeks, not enough time. Not enough time. You can see the beginning of fusion, but for that to be really solidly fused, it's really going to take you a good solid 3 months. And in many instances, it could be 6 months. And it's an ongoing process. I've had patients who were smokers. They may stop smoking for those first 3 months and go back to smoking, and then the graft resorbs, and you do the study at 6 months, and they're no longer fused. So it's typically a period of 3 months. Now that changes markedly. If you have a one-level discectomy, okay, certainly autograft, the fusion rate, I had done a series where it was like 100% in about 60 patients, but other studies may be a few percentage points, 3 to 5% don't go on to fuse. You add a two-level discectomy, that skyrockets to like 12 to 20% that might be failing to fuse already by that time.
In the upper right-hand image there, I'm gonna go back one more time.
Right.
Right at the fusion where the blue arrow is,
Yeah.
is the radio dense areas fusion of the cortical bone with the bone upper and lower levels.
Yeah. Well, what you're seeing here, this is the anterior aspect of this. In this case, it's an iliac tricortical graft, okay?
Right.
But what you're seeing here, the sort of fuzziness, that
Yeah.
is the typically it's the interspace between the cancellous bone of the end plate, because you're shaving down the end plate to get this graft in. So it is the interface between the cancellous bone of the vertebral body and the cancellous bone of your graft itself. And that's what's integrating typically here. By the way, look at the posterior ridges. I'm going to show you a better example of that shortly. But that's what you're seeing. And sometimes it can be misleading and look overly, quote, good, but physiologically, it's going to take you again those 3 months.
So in that image, is it fuse or fusing?
Fusing, if it's only 3 months,
Okay.
solidly fused pretty much if it's 6 months.
And 6 months, you see it instead of the irregular border, it should be a more smooth border.
It becomes a more hyperdense border.
Okay. It's all hyperdense. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Great point.
And so here, I'm just going over, multi-level anterior discectomy infusions. It's important when you do these operations, not only are you doing your multi-level anterior discectomy infusion, your single or multi-levels, but look at the posterior ridges. You have to have the posterior ridges to prevent you from pistoning into the spinal canal. Now, that pistoning could be a trial spacer that some of the systems use. And watch out, because some of the systems do not have a stop device. So you can just go right into the canal, especially if you're not doing intraoperative real-time lateral fluoro. But you have to realize that the safest thing to do is to always have a posterior ridge. And it's not just a tiny little thin, pledge lid of bone that you're putting there, because otherwise the graft could just knock that off and knock it into the canal. But this is a figurative diagram, but just imagine if this is thicker, which is what we usually do. But you typically will drill into the vertebral end plates. You don't usually want to go completely through it, because then you may weaken that end plate by 50%. And if you've done that above and below, because that's what's going on here, you can get those grafts pistoning into each other, which I'm going to mention shortly. But leave that posterior ridge.
If you mentioned pistoning, does that mean that I could see the man flexing and forcing that graft going backwards? Is that what you mean?
I mean, intraoperatively,
Oh,
that the
intraoperatively.
graft can be inadvertently pushed right into the spinal cord. It could be a trial spacer, it could be the actual graft itself, but absolutely, postoperatively, if these grafts are in and there's no posterior ridge and they flex or extend with greater force, yes, those grafts can piston into the spinal canal.
So in surgery, it's operator dependent.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one expert that I recently was I recently read in a deposition, oh, I never use a posterior ridge, and the next breath is, yes, I've had, grafts piston into the spinal canal. So the answer is, this is a safety maneuver that basically all of us were taught when doing anterior discectomy infusions, at least in neurosurgery.
You got to leave enough of a ridge, though, so it isn't fragile and just breaks off, right?
That's right. In other words, you see this is pretty small. I would at least bring it out at least another 50% so that you're here. So
Yeah.
your graft is actually going to go in here, and then you have a nice wide, thick ridge that's going to prevent you from pistoning into the canal.
Okay, great points.
So this is just an example of a two-level interbody fusion. Here's your interbody graft, and then here's your two-level plate and your vertebral body screws that may be placed along with that. There's a whole different discussion about what kind of plates are used these days. We typically use dynamic plates. We no longer use the fixed plates, because the screws actually in the Asculap plate, the screw can, head can actually move up and down the slots and allow the graft to compress, which is how it fuses. Rather than having stress shielding, where if you have a fixed plate and graft system, it can prevent the compression that's needed for a fusion to occur. So
Okay.
very important as to what systems you use and why.
Yeah, good point.
So iliac autograft, this is still a gold standard. It's still the cheapest in the different hospitals, different institutions across the country, certainly in any other country. Iliac autograft itself, to harvest this may take you an extra half hour. The morbidity of it has been grossly over-exaggerated, especially by Medtronic. And years ago, they came under scrutiny because of their ultra-exaggeration of the complications, risks and complications associated with autograft. Their devices and everybody else's devices, basically be it cadaver, allograft, PEEK cages, all of these are typically $6,000 or $7,000 when the hospitals buy them. But the beauty for the hospitals is the hospitals are going to multiply that amount 6 or 7 times before they then charge the insurance carriers. So here's just an example of a PEEK graft, a PEEK or metal device. So there are all kinds of devices out there. Another PEEK metal device. Here you have screws affixed to the plate, and here's your graft. And there's a hole in here, by the way, where you can put in bone morph. You can put in. You're not supposed to use any bone morphogenetic protein in front of the spinal cord, but they do put in what's called demineralized bone matrix. It's cadaver graft and mixtures thereof. This is a PEEK metal device. This is ROIC. There have been some major complications associated with that. They could be just all metal, or indeed, as in this instance, a metal cage. And this may be supplemented with a plate as well. Each of these devices, by the way, when you look at the literature and you review medical legal cases, you know, they have their own risks and complications associated with them.
There's no paper, we can go back to that for just a second. There's no paper, or is there a paper in the literature comparing these devices?
There are lots of papers. Usually they try to compare one device with the other. The classic is that they're comparing, you know, cadaver allograft with one of the PEEK devices. Others, if they're well-designed studies, it's going to choose between one or two rather than a whole slew at the same time. Metal cages, here you have to put in a fair amount of, they say, well, sometimes you just harvest the autograft from the operation itself. And then you put in the demineralized bone matrix. This is going to take longer to fuse, and then there'll be the metal plate across there. This one has a very high pseudoarthrosis rate as well as slippage rate. There are tons of studies out there comparing one with the other. And then you have to read these very carefully to say, is this a white paper? Is this really a comparison, a valid comparison between this product A and product B, or is it a very biased presentation? And in many instances, as an editor of a journal, SNI, we get lots of papers called white papers where they're just trying to use it as a cheap way to advertise a new device that hasn't actually been, you know, correctly vetted. And I can't emphasize to you how many times some of these devices were never appropriately tried out in different animal models to see whether or not they're actually safe, much less effective.
So the rep from the company may hand you some articles, but you should look at them very carefully, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, you know, you can say, look, you know, this Dr. So-and-so, look at the article that he wrote. Well, if it's a white paper, then you can take that, you know, under advisement. One of the papers in 2019, I just reviewed the risks and complications of multiple papers for anterior discectomy infusions. So these are the smaller operations, swallowing difficulties. Lots of series are going to say this is up to 30 to 40%, especially if it's multi-level corpectomies, you know, post-op hematomas. They're not all epidural hematomas. They can be wound hematomas. They can be retropharyngeal hematomas, wound hematomas. Not everything is an epidural hematoma. Spinal cord injuries, recurrent laryngeal nerve palsies. You know, we used to say this is more frequent if you operate from the right versus the left. Ron Applebaum years ago said, oh no, the rate is similar on both sides. The incidence of a CSF leak should be relatively small. Again, do yourself a favor, use an operating microscope to try and minimize that risk of infection is there. We all say, you know, people can reach the front of their neck to maybe wash their neck, but they can never reach the back. That's why the risk of infection with posterior cervical surgery is typically, you know, 3 to 6 to 9%. Horner syndrome, that's getting the sympathetic chain. As you go down lower in the cervical spine, if you start operating at C5, 6, 6, 7, it's easier to get a Horner syndrome because the sympathetic change deviates medially as you're going more distally. Esophageal perforation, again, and pseudarthrosis rates. Look at this. This was taken from one of the series. 4.3%, that's with a cadaver graft, that's not autograft. 24% with a two level, 40, up to 42% with a three level. Yet you hear your colleagues all the time saying, oh, I just did a three level ACDF. Look at these morbidities associated with anterior cervical discectomy infusion. I'm going to mention later on a cervical laminoforaminotomy for either a single or two level unilateral disease. Almost all of these complications, we're not going to call them complications, we're going to call them adverse events, can occur with that. And by the way, when you're dealing with your medical legal colleagues, these should always be, in my view, termed, is it negligence that caused it? Was it a technical surgical error? Was it a mistake? Is it really acceptable? And, quote, part and parcel of the operation to have that spinal cord injury? Or was there a reason for it? Was there a mistake made that led to that error, that injury having occurred? And that can be true for almost anything in these categories. Otherwise, the whole notation of, quote, complications may be allowing surgeons to just commit egregious errors or act in a negligent fashion without any consequences.
Well, I don't know if I'm the patient and I want to wind up with a cord injury or a CSF leak or Horner syndrome or pseudoarthrosis. I don't know what you want to call it, but it ain't good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you got to look at it from the patient's point of view, not from the doctor's point of view.
Yeah. And everything we're doing here by doing these lectures and everything else is to try and enhance the safety of surgery that's being done on patients, not only in this country, but around the world. Because what we the these lectures are available to how many people in how many countries?
105 countries, thousands of people.
Yeah. So I like to sprinkle throughout the lecture some of the medical legal cases that I've seen. This was a patient who had a two-level anterior discectomy infusion done. By the way, at the second level, the patient had no disease, but it was performed by somebody who was a brain or a skull-based surgeon, not even a spine surgeon. One day he said, okay, I'm going to do a two-level ACDF. There was no reason to operate at the second level of surgery. There was no disease on the MR. He had no neurological deficit to correlate with that. Okay. He actually did the first level in terms of the decompression safely. The patient was okay. Second level, he literally plunges into the canal and actually takes a bite out of the spinal cord. That's the only and easiest way to put it. To the point where the assistant was shocked, astounded, and the patient actually jumped. And the patient was quadriplegic postoperatively. This image is similar to what the patient's image might have been. You know, here's your anterior cervical disc at a single level, no disease at the level above or below. And this again is an image similar to the patient, but I couldn't medical legally take the patient's images. And you can see the cord swelling after the malfeasance, after pistoning into that canal and taking a bite out of it, et cetera.
You see the edema, the whiteness in the cord is what you're talking
That
about.
is that is the white image that you're seeing in the cord coming from that disc space level. Now, what you're going to see in some of these cases is the surgeons turn around and say, oh no, it's the white cord syndrome. Now, the white cord syndrome is something where there is actually no explanation as to why the damage occurred. It's a quote stroke to the cord. Here you have a direct reason why damage occurred to the cord. And in most other instances, the majority, the vast majority of cases, there is an explanation as to why the cord injury occurred, and or that there's residual pathology or the cord is tethered over residual disease. White cord syndrome is very rare and totally reserved for instances where there is really no other explanation other than the spontaneous stroke to the cord. So it should not be the excuse for not only seeing this on a post-op study, but then ignoring it and not reoperating on that patient. Because this is a good example where now you have a swollen cord. Shouldn't you at least be doing a decompression from behind? give that cord more room.
Very good explanation. This lecture on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery is using the K-line in choosing approaches to anterior cervical spine lesions. It's a 40-minute lecture with discussion.
So we're going to look at or focus on how do you make a decision as to whether or not to do an anterior operation, a posterior operation, or a 360 on patients with cervical disease. So how do you decide which direction to do multi-level surgery in? And here, you need to look at what's called the K-line. It's the vertical line from the mid-C2 to 7. A positive K-line, which I'm showing you here, you go mid-C2, you put a dot in the spinal canal. You go mid-C7, you put another dot in the spinal canal. You put a line, or, you know, a vertical line between the two. If your pathology is in front of that line, anterior to that line, okay, you have a choice. You could actually do, that's called a positive K-line, by the way, anterior surgery, posterior surgery, or 360 surgery. And what I'm going to discuss and argue later, if you have that option, doing a posterior cervical procedure does not incur many of those risks and adverse events that you see with anterior cervical surgery. So why wouldn't you choose that? Okay. On the other hand, okay, you may have the negative K line. What are you seeing with that? The negative K line. Here's the top, the bottom. If your disease extends behind that line or posterior to that line, like in this instance, this would be, looks like OPLL, it's likely, more likely than not, you need to do an anterior operation. And the reason, you know, I always say likely this, that, and the other, because there may be other circumstances where you may modify, you know, your technique and what you choose to do. Many surgeons, by the way, don't even know that this line exists.
I was just going to ask you, how many people use the K line as a deciding factor? Is it common or is it not common?
It's very uncommon. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, you come to depositions where the person being deposed has no idea what this is, has never encountered this. And they just say, oh, I just gestalt it. And hey, I go for it. Or the other day I was speaking to a relatively new surgeon who said, well, I know how to do the anterior discectomy infusions. I don't know how to do the posterior cervical. In this case, it was the laminophoraminotomy. So I'm just going to do what I know how to do.
So you've used this for years, right?
Yes, yes. And it's been out for years. I mean, this is published. I'm not making this line up, okay? But again, here is your negative K line. Disease, you see, is posterior to that line seen over here and here. And here is the study that I'm quoting here, the negative K-line. You're likely to choose an anterior surgery for discs, spurs, spondylosis, stenosis, and or OPLL.
That was a paper from 2012.
Yes.
That's 12 years ago.
Oh, yeah. And there are many more that have discussed this since then. It warrants single versus multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion. So here's just a figurative diagram of a one-level anterior corpectomy infusion. And then you have your plate and you've placed your screws, okay? And here's an example of a multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion, plate and screws. But I'm showing you here that if you have done more than a one-level anterior corpectomy, a two or more level, this graft and plate has to be stabilized by a posterior fusion. If you do not do an accompanying posterior fusion, that graft is going to extrude at least 20% of the time if it's a two-level corpectomy, and at least 50% of the time if it's a three-level corpectomy or more.
Good, you mentioned that. That's really an important point.
Yeah, and I'm going to repeat that, actually. So here, I'm just going to show you again, you know, your anterior corpectomy infusion. By the way, watch out for those instances. Instead of doing the one-level corpectomy, some people are going to say, well, I'm not so good at the one-level corpectomy. I'm better at the discectomy. Well, two-level anterior discectomy, and I'll show you a case at the end, can leave disease behind that vertebral body, especially OPLL. Okay. And if you're taking off a good portion of that end plate, you have to watch out for pistoning of the graft between those end plates. So you're going to hire with a two-level ACDF, you're going to have more subsidence, body fractures, and graft extrusion. So here's your two-level anterodiscectomy infusion. Okay. And I'm showing you this again. You have your grafts that are placed here. But again, you've taken off a portion of the end plate here, portion of the end plate here. You can weaken that end plate by up to 50%, depending on how much of the end plate you've taken out. If you do that, what you can risk is that the grafts start pistoning into the cancellous bone of that intervening vertebral body, and it can result in the vertebral body fracture and graft extrusion.
So
So this is what
how do you avoid that?
do your one-level corpectomy. You have also two interfaces here to fuse. Here you're going to have four interfaces to fuse. And remember, I had just said before, with a two-level anterodiscectomy infusion, your pseudarthrosis rate there is going to be about 24%, and it's much less with a one-level corpectomy.
Good, good. Okay, terrific.
And here's an example of where you have to really evaluate the images, understand your images, read your images. Don't just believe whatever your radiologists are telling you. But here's a midline sagittal MR. Here's C2. Here's C3. Well, certainly looks like a big, huge soft disc, by the way, that's coming down. And look, it's extending to the mid C3 body level. But it's also going down to the C4-5, to the C3-4 level, not further below. Okay. Your stenosis, your disease is anterior. By the way, look on the MR, your cord markedly compressed in a high signal that you're seeing in the cord. And so this would be a good patient for a one-level corpectomy where here's C2, anteriorly you take off the vertebral body of three, then you have no trouble accessing the entirety of this disc extrusion that's going at least to the mid aspect of the vertebral body. You're coming down directly on it, you can see it. It's ending at the C3-4 disc space, so you can do a C2 to C4 anterior corpectomy infusion, put whatever graft and plate you're going to put in, and then this might be, your X-ray post-op where you have your corpectomy, plate and graft are in place, and this is just showing you this is your vertebral body graft. You see here, this is where that graft ends, and then
Yeah.
you've got your ridges posteriorly here and here, preventing that graft from going further back.
Yeah, good.
Okay. And you have to measure and shorten your anterior and posterior dimension of your graft to take that into account because, again, you don't want that graft to be pistoned into the canal by forgetting to put in those posterior ridges. And then here's your plate, et cetera. Well, here's an example where if you just did the MR alone, you could be in big trouble because on the MRI scan, it was misread that this is C2, this is C3, this is C3-4 was misread as a soft disc herniation. And just to focus on that, misread as a soft disc. By the way, note on the MR how you can see, look at the high signal in the cord opposite this level of compression, right? Here's the cord coming down, here's the cord coming up. High cord signal, marked cord compression as well. Okay, you do the CT scan, and this is the same patient, and look at your calcification, ossification. This is actually OPLL, a version of OPLL called the other form that often looks like a disc or mimics a disc. And it's mid-body to mid-body. Well, to do this, you're going to have to go probably, C2 to C5 in order to adequately remove and resect all this calcification in front of the cord. Okay, so a good use of your CT and your MR. And how you can be led down the garden path if you just do that MR alone. Some people are going to say, oh, the CAT scan, it's too much radiation. That's usually not the reason. Some of them say, well, I really don't want to delay by getting a CAT scan because I want to send that patient in and get the surgery done really quickly before they go to somebody else or change their mind or something like that. CAT scan can give you so much information, and CAT scan can just be smarter than you are. If you just obtain more of them, it can keep you out of trouble. You don't have to be brilliant to order it. Again, emphasizing the CAT scan does not show you definition of the chord itself cannot show you the high chord signal, but shows you the bony changes. That otherwise, this is the negative image that you're going to see on an MR where bone appears hypo-intense, and here it is on the CAT scan, hyperdense.
Let me ask you a question. Go back to that picture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the operating room, and I get a lateral C-spine to
right.
see if my graft is in accurately. Is that going to be a good determinant? Is a magnification going to be missed? Is it can I feel comfortable with that?
I mean, to get a lateral cervical X-ray to determine if you've taken out a sufficient amount of the OPLL.
Yeah, so in that I put a graft in and it didn't go in too far. Is
yeah.
that going to be helpful, or is there some error in that and with the technique and everything else?
Well, I think if you've planned to do your corpectomy and do the resection that we've discussed, I think the lateral cervical X-ray will probably do. I mean, a lot of us are using, you know, the intraoperative O-arm. You just bring that in, swing it around, boom, there's your CAT scan to tell you if you've adequately resected the pathology. So that's preferable if you have access to that.
Okay.
If, however, you're doing an anterior discectomy infusion here, you're going to be shaving more and more of the vertebral body. You're going to end up with less than half of the vertebral body above, half of the vertebral body below. Remember, if you're taking off that end plate and you've taken off that end plate completely, you've got a 50% strength left in this body and that body, and you have a good chance that if you put a graft in there that it may fracture out, plus the fact that you have not adequately and accurately completely decompressed the degree of cord compression above and below that disc space level.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, though, a lateral cervical X-ray, if you have ossification of the anterior longitudinal ligament, can, on the other hand, be very, very effective.
Yeah,
if
I
you
can see
just
that.
See the calcification directly anteriorly. But
I'm just wondering about relying on it 100%. Oh, it says I'm okay.
You can't. You can't.
Can't.
And it's a good reason to get a post-op CT scan if you have any question about it, or to actually presumptively get a CT to confirm that you've adequately resected disease. And we used to, with multi-level OPLL, all the time get post-operative CAT scans to see what we have. This is just to reemphasize that if you're doing multi-level anterior corpectomy infusions, you have to accompany it by a posterior fusion to stabilize your anterior graft. So this was a study. Vaccaro did a study in 98. I had a study also, Journal of Spinal Disorder, in 2000, for a three-level anterior corpectomy infusion, a 50% risk of extrusion without an accompanying posterior fusion. And this is not something you want to do one day and then come back the next day. Ideally, you're doing one, you're flipping the patient over, and you're doing it immediately to avoid getting that graft extruding in the first post-op day, or you're keeping them intubated overnight, et cetera. So that's a C3-7 anterior corpectomy infusion, three levels. Here's a two-level anterior corpectomy infusion, C2, C3, 4, 5. This is down to 6. Obviously, that's a metal construct, but without that posterior fusion, 20% risk of extrusion. Alternatively, here you have your anterior strut graft, et cetera, and that posterior fusion is going to help stabilize your anterior graft. Again, same anesthetic, very good idea. If you have to do it, flipping it overnight, keep that patient intubated overnight. I can't emphasize how critically important that is, because if you then have to reintubate that patient the next day, that's a good opportunity for that anterior plate and graft system to extrude, or for you to injure the patient in some other way. Here's an example where you did a two-level corpectomy and put in a metal strut graft with a plate. Here's C2, C3, C4. 5 and 6 have come out, and here is C7. Now, this is an immediate post-op study, and here everything is there. That's a two-dimensional CT. Here, on the other hand, this is your two-dimensional CT scan. When look at your C4 body, that graft has completely fractured out, and C7, forget it, that's morcellated and completely fractured out as well. Here's your plate and your screw. Everything is anterior to the vertebral body in this instance. So that's what can happen if you don't do that simultaneous posterior fusion in these cases. Now I just want to introduce, you know, ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. Too often in the States in particular, people say, well, It's a disease that they're seeing in Asia, but we really don't have it here. And I'm just emphasizing, you see this in the United States in about at least 25% of our patients. It's another reason to get that CAT scan in addition to the MR if you fail to read OPLL on the MRI scan, and the findings can sometimes be more subtle. So this is just figuratively what OPLL looks like. It's behind the vertebral bodies at single or multiple levels, and it compresses the cord, and it's defined as four types. I actually visited Hirabayashi in Japan, and we went over this. Continuous is when it goes behind multiple vertebral bodies. The next kind is called segmental, is you have ossification just behind the vertebral bodies. Here, continuous, it crosses the interspace. Here, it does not. But then you have the mixed form up here, where you have continuous in one area and you have the segmental in the other. So that's the third form of the mixed form. And what may be completely baffling may be the final one, which is the other form, which is it's at the disc space or appears to be at the disc space, but in actuality goes above and below the disc space, just like the example that I had just showed you. This can be the most risky because surgeons will typically go in based on an MR, assuming that they're going to encounter a disc, and before they know it, they're in the middle of the spinal cord, and that patient's quadriplegic because they forgot to get a CAT scan and to acknowledge or to look for more extensive disease. So here you're looking at a patient with a negative K sign and multi-level OPLL, because that's what we're going to look at here, and likely requires. This patient's going to likely require an anterior operation because if you put in the line C2 to 7, all this OPLL is going to be in front of you and you've got to resect that. Okay, so here's in color, the same diagram. Basically, these were actually drawn by Joe Epstein, my dad, who was, a neurosurgeon. And another example, though, where you may have OPLL and the patient has kyphosis, and you can see the anterior angulation here. Okay. And there's clear reversal of the cervical lordosis, another reason to do an anterior procedure, because if your K line is here and your K line's down here, all of this bone is going to be is going to go behind that line, indicating you're going to have to go from the front. When you get a CAT scan or you add a CAT scan to the MRI scan that you're getting in patients, it may show you any one of these three signs of OPLL extending to and through the dura, and especially the double layer sign will give you 80% plus leak if you do anterior operations, which you may still have to do, but you can then be prepared to deal with it. So here, this is a typical single layer sign where you know where this is. It's a little, it can be very regular, sometimes a little irregular, but the C sign often will accompany the single layer sign. And it means that there's sort of a chunk that goes off to the side. I had described this years ago. And what happens is the dura on the side can become imbricated or enfolded in OPLL. So you've got to watch it with this. But very much so, the double layer sign in these two images, you see how you have bone, the vertebral body, and then that hypodense area, and then that hyperdense ossification. That ossification is inside the dura. That hypodense area is the dura. So in these cases, there is going to be no interface, no dural margin that's going to allow you to avoid a CSF leak. It tells you if you have to go anteriorly, because look at the size of this compression. If you have to go anteriorly, be prepared to deal with that leak and be prepared ahead of time. Prepare your patient. Make sure your OR has the equipment that you need. Again, an example of a negative K line. Here's your K line going cephalad caudad. OPLL is behind that K line. And here's an actual two-dimensional CAT scan. Look at this. This is all OPLL, continuous C2, C3, C4, and then a little discontinuity at the C4-5 level. But you see the way it becomes hypodense and hyperdense again. This chunk is intradurally, as is this chunk, as is this entire chunk here. So that's going to be, your negative K sign with OPLL and multiple foci here, 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 and here of your double layer signs. So you're not only going to have an anterior leak, but it's going to cover many, many levels, and you've got to be prepared to deal with that. On an MRI scan, this may be what you're going to see, C2, C3, C4, but look at 5, 6, and 7. This is actually OPLL. How do I know that? Because the hypo-intense area not only crosses the disc space and goes up half the body, but look at the separation between the posterior aspect of this entire vertebral body. This is C5, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is C6, and coming all the way down to the 6, 7 level, sort of almost midway. In this instance, this is going to be OPLL, and you really need to get a CAT scan to get more definition and also look at the MR showing you the high signal in the cord. So you're going to have to be prepared to do a very extensive resection in this case. Here is your single layer sign of OPLL. Everything behind here is ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament on your axial image. This is a case where you can see this is the double layer sign, calcification here, intradural here. This may be a single layer sign over here with a C sign because it's going off to the side. But in short, the CAT scan's your friend. It's going to show you this. It's going to tell you how you might have to prepare to deal with this intraoperatively because it's going to be extensive. And these are just some other cases of negative K lines. An MR scan, this is C2. Look at 3, 4, 5. High signal in the cord. Look at the MR scan showing this hypo-intense mass behind multiple levels. Okay, that is showing you, that is telling you, this is OPLL. These are not discs. These are misread as discs all the time, but wrong decision. On your axial studies, you may see a mass that's this big. Do yourself a favor, get that CAT scan and plan according to where the disease is. And both of these MRs are going to show you the hardcore signal for this OPLL with, you're going to have to do a corpectomy of C3 to get this. It's all the way like three quarters of the way up the body and all the way down to like C5, 6. And you're going to have to do a strut from C2 after you've taken out 3, 4, and 5, strut to C6, and then do a posterior fusion to stabilize that. Okay. And here another example of multi-level OPLL seen here. Again, figuratively, here's your OPLL, OPLL drawn here. Here's your anterior graft that you may be placing, anterior graft and strut here, or you may be using a cage to put in your strut graft and your cage and your plate and your screws, et cetera. Again, when you do the multi-level corpectomy and fusion, you have then decompressed the spinal cord through that entire extent, anteriorly and posteriorly, and your cord can then migrate posteriorly away from where your anterior OPLL used to be. It's removed. The damage, the risk, the negligence of doing an ACDF is that you end up stretching or damaging the cord over residual OPLL left behind the individual vertebral bodies. So I showed you this before. You're doing the discectomy, discectomy, discectomy. But what about the OPLL here, just figuratively shown in here, that you're not accessing? You may have some surgeons say, oh, I can access that with a curette. Well, no, they can't. Or they access it with a curette, they damage the cord, and they get a massive CSF leak doing so. But here, leaving behind that OPLL, you're going to end up with an anterior discectomy fusion, literally stretching your cord over this residual disease. This is a very complicated case that involved multiple issues. This patient preoperatively had actually an MR similar to this because I couldn't use the exact images, okay? Preoperatively, the MR was misread, misinterpreted by the surgeon as discs, as multi-level disease, and he did a multi-level discectomy fusion. By the way, he did not follow the advice of his radiologist, who questioned whether there was OPLL and told him to get a CAT scan, and he didn't. He failed to diagnose OPLL, did the multi-level anterior discectomy fusion, stretched the cord over multi-level residual OPLL, He also incurred massive anterior cervical CSF leaks, and I'll show you how he did not correctly deal with that, and even sustained a vertebral artery injury because he was too far off to the side. And this patient was quadriplegic post-op. Well, what should he have done? He should have done a multi-level anterior corpectomy infusion with a strut and a plate, and then done a simultaneous posterior fusion. Okay, but that unfortunately was not what was done in this case. Instead, I'm just showing you he did a multi-level discectomy infusion, putting a bone graft at two levels and stretching the cord over the residual OPLL, which I'm showing you figuratively here. And then here, I'm trying to illustrate to you with your ACDF grafts, you put the grafts in at these multiple levels, but look at the OPLL that's still going to be left over behind that. That's where you're stretching the cord. That's where you're damaging the cord. Okay. And in some instances, other surgeons, they're actually just getting down to the OPLL and leaving it behind completely. I remember visiting Leuven in Europe, and I was talking to them because the surgeon had done an artificial disc replacement. He said, "Look at this post-op scan. Look at all the calcification post-op." And I looked at the study and I said, "This is OPLL. You never took it out in the first place." So you have to be very careful when doing these procedures. Do the right operation for the right reason. Spinal fluid leaks with anterior cervical surgery with an ACDF, very, very low risk, 0.2 to 1.7%. But you get to OPLL, it's as high as 6 to 12%. So anticipating this leak should be part of your modus operandi. And again, if you get that pre-op CT scan and you see a single layer sign, as I'm showing you here, and the positive C sign and your double layer signs, then you know that there's a problem in these cases. And again, here's your CT. This is a post-op CT, kind of like what the CT showed in this patient. The CT showed a double layer sign postoperatively at multiple levels, and that's your intervening dura. And this is basically here where only some of this was removed and most of this was basically left behind. And again, right to and through the dura. When you have a patient where you suspect you're going to get an anterior cervical leak, it is very, the best thing to do is to prepare and drape at the very beginning of surgery. You mark your anterior incision, but you then prep and drape out for a wound peritoneal shunt where you can put a shunt right in the neck with a dome, bring it down subcutaneously to the para-umbilical region. Well, the para-umbilical region is here, but maybe just over the liver, where you can actually put in a distal end of a shunt here if you have to do that intraoperatively. And you want to do that because if you don't do that and you just put in a lumbar drain, CSF, just because it's easiest for it to egress into your wound, may asphyxiate that patient, much less cause that wound to dehisce and fall apart. So in the early days, we use a unishunt. These days, you can use whichever shunt you want, but track the shunt catheter from the neck to the abdomen for that wound peritoneal shunt. Also, postoperatively prepare to have available to you the placement of a lumbar drain. It's like belt and suspenders. You can control the amount that you're going to drain with the system that you're using. And by the way, when you put in the wound peritoneal shunt, you're going to have a horizontal vertical valve to control the amount that's draining if that patient happens to be upright. The other alternative, too, is here to just immediately go to a lumboperitoneal shunt, because what's going to happen is you're going to be draining CSF in this patient. It's still going to be draining, and you're going to want to take that drain to the outside out in about 7 days so you don't get an infection. That's just at the point where your leak may be in full force. And so a lumboperitoneal shunt from the get-go or in a delayed fashion may be what you then choose to do. Now, in this case, I actually was allowed to use the actual postoperative CAT scan. Postoperative CAT scan, easy to get, quick, but what's that going to show you? It's going to show you the location of the graft, the screws, plate, et cetera. It is not going to show you what's happening to the cord, okay? This is what the MRI scan showed. By the way, both of these studies were done in a delayed fashion. They waited a number of hours with this patient quadriplegic post-op. This is your post-operative actual MRI. And here is your That is your Duracil. They put in Duracil anterior to the cord. It is contraindicated on the package insert to use Duracil anterior to the spinal cord because it can cause a mass, and in this case, cause massive cord compression. Seeing these findings, the radiologist said, "Wow, there's a lot of anterior cord compression." But instead, the surgeon did a laminectomy. A laminectomy from behind here was not going to really solve this patient's problem because it was such massive anterior cord compression, and this patient ended up remaining quadriplegic. Postoperatively, unfortunately, the surgeon, or fortunately, the surgeon left town for a while and left associates in town. For 3 weeks, they did no other studies. 3 weeks later, the patient was transferred to another institution. They reoperated on that patient. It was too late. You know, nothing came back. So it's a combination of errors. It may be the surgeon themselves. It may be the associates. It may be the adjunct of personnel in the hospital. But everybody should be looking at.
And this part three lectures is on pearls and pitfalls of anterior and posterior cervical spine surgery, is on the K-line and choosing posterior approaches to cervical spine lesions. It's also a 40-minute lecture and discussion.
Should be looking at these cases saying, what should be done? This patient is paraplegic. This is a problem. This should be dealt with.
I know we take a break here for just a minute because you're going to get into posterior, right?
Yes.
And I had, I, we'll just, you and I will talk for a couple of minutes and we'll start again. I'm going to leave it run. So I thought that was excellent. It really, a lot of good tips and clues there. And I may divide it into, it took us about an hour for that or 55 minutes. It was good. I think we will divide it into anterior and posterior, but I also may do two things. I want your input on that. Is the first part was the introduction, which was the anatomy, the imaging, and the neurologic presentation. We could also have it as a four-part series. Then the choice is, do we use the how to do the shunt separately or not? If you have it as a separate talk, I'm thinking out loud here. I'm not sure it's as meaningful as if you attach it to this the subsequent anterior series. What do you think about all those ideas?
I think you could do the anterior and up to anterior discectomy infusion. I think you could segment out the anterior corpectomy infusion and then do that as a segment and then do the posterior as another segment. And just say this is, you know, three part series. Maybe this is part A, B, and C.
Okay.
Because I think the images that are shown with the review of the CAT scan and MR are sort of critical to the anterior and posterior surgical decision-making processes.
So we break the anterior cervical at after it's a simple one level. Okay, I think we can find a break there. Okay, I think that's so we leave the anatomy with a simple anterior cervical discectomy infusion, then more complex anterior operations and posterior operations. Okay. I think that's good.
You know, see how you feel about that. The other thing I was telling you too is I have also separate lectures on anterior corpectomy infusions and posterior cervical. So we could see what you think of those just as maybe supplemental, more detailed,
Well,
in-depth
we
views.
could do those. We could go through what you're going to do, and we could, it's up to you because you're the one who's doing this, is you could, we could record it, but you could use them as a later, two later entries in the series, more approaching more complex cases.
Okay,
Something
good.
like
Because I
that.
have them. I've worked on them already.
So it's up to you how you want to do it, but I think what we're doing is putting together a library. It's terrific. So this is 10 recorded 10, but no, I think we're doing pretty good. That's good. Okay, you want to go ahead with that? You can just go on and say about posterior cervical surgery. You might introduce it.
Next, we're going to look at posterior cervical surgery. How do you make a decision for a posterior cervical operation? And one of the main points that I'm going to emphasize here is, and we're going to integrate what's called the K-line as to how we make this decision. If you have the opportunity to do a posterior cervical procedure rather than an anterior or a 360, the morbidity of that choice is, you're going to have an easier postoperative course, easier postoperative outcome, and reduced morbidity, fewer adverse events associated with it. So I think it's something that you have to look at very, very carefully. Again, this is sort of your typical posterior cervical procedure. You've got the patient in a three-pin head holder. By the way, I always use a three-pin head holder. Do not use the face masks. You can get pressure in the eyes. The actual position of the neck can change. You can end up with jugular compression, et cetera. Here you have absolute control. You can get a cervical X-ray to make sure the patient is completely neutral. And here you can see we've marked out the posterior cervical incision that we're going to use. By the way, SEP, somatosensory evoked potential, motor evoked potential, and EMG monitoring is important. By taping the shoulders, watch out, you can actually incur a plexus injury, brachial plexus injury. So you want to make sure that you have your monitoring going while you're positioning the patient for cervical surgery, much less posterior cervical surgery, because it can save you from creating a disaster from the get-go, much less hyperextending the patient or hypoflexing the patient.
Terrific points.
It's best to choose a posterior operation if you can for a cervical disc. As I said, I spoke to a young colleague the other day, and he said, I was never trained to do a laminophoremonotomy. I'd like to learn how to do those. I was trained to do an ACDF, so that's what I do. And I said, but you're talking about doing a C6-7, C7-T1 ACDF on a pretty large patient. Don't you think the morbidity would be much reduced and the patient would be happier if you did a laminophoremonotomy at those levels instead? We have in the SNI Digital series an entire lecture devoted to laminophoremonotomies that Jim and I discussed. So we will just going to refer you to that, but just as a refresher, this is a lateral. An image here of a lateral spur and lateral and foraminal root compression, no cord compression here. Here is your laminophoremonotomy with your medial facetectomy foraminotomy. By the way, watch out, there's your vertebral artery out there. You don't want to get into that. So you have to keep your wits about you when you're doing these procedures. You have root exposed, you often have very little cord exposed. That's why the morbidity of these procedures is minimal. And typically, you do not have to fuse these patients. Here is a figurative diagram of a disc herniation. If it goes too medially, you might want to go anteriorly, but if it's very foraminal, as in this case, you don't. And this is what that foraminotomy, it translates to a window procedure that you may be performing. By the way, if you're doing this at C7-T1, very likely you're going to have to do an accompanying fusion at that level.
You're going to have to do a what at that level?
A fusion at
Oh, fusion.
C7-T1, if you're
Okay.
doing a foraminotomy at
Okay.
C7-T1 because
Here.
of the cervicothoracic junction. But again, here's an MR of a lateral and foraminal disc where you could approach it from behind. You can use your Penfield elevators to identify that nerve root because the arms are typically down by the side. The nerve root in your image are typically coming down. In the old days, we used to put the patient in a sitting position with their arms upward, so the root would go up, but now it goes down. So you have to use a Penfield elevator to get into the axilla or the armpit of that nerve, and then use your downbiting curette. You can use a downbiting curette to remove spurs and/or osteophytes that may go laterally and foraminally. And again, watch out if you're concerned about a vertebral artery problem here too. But we're going to go back to our discussion of the K-line and how you use a K-line. For posterior cervical surgery, you want that positive K-line. Okay, that means that mid between C2 and the posterior elements and C7 and the posterior elements, you draw a vertical line. Your pathology is anterior to that line. Again, your options are going to be multiple. You can have anterior, posterior, or 360 surgery. Use your posterior surgical options if you can. This is going to be exclusive of the negative K-line, which we have previously discussed. So the positive K-line means your disease is anterior to the K-line, your surgical options, anterior, posterior, 360 surgery. Best to choose posterior surgery because of the more limited morbidity associated with these procedures. So here's an example of a patient who has a positive K-line, and you may choose to do a laminectomy and a posterior fusion for disc, spur, stenosis, or spondylosis. And here you can see your pathology is anterior to that K-line. Okay, so it's pretty simple to remember, pretty simple to measure. And again, your posterior surgical operations are going to limit the risk of a CSF leak, much less the other risks and complications. Your posterior cervical procedures, your dysphagia, unless the patient's intubated for a very long time, is going to be much, much less. Risk of your CSF leaks, much less. Risk of a carotid injury, an internal jugular injury, recurrent laryngeal injury, a phrenic nerve injury. I mean, all of the list goes on and on. You can choose to do a laminectomy to decompress the cord. The cord is going to migrate posteriorly as long as you have, in this case, you have a good cervical lordosis. And here's your laminectomy with posterior migration of the cord into that space that you've created. Ventral kyphosis, contraindication relatively for performing posterior cervical surgery. Sometimes you may have surgeons who may do an anterior discectomy graft above and below the pathology to throw the patient into some degree of lordosis to do a posterior procedure. But here again, a positive K-line. Here's your X-ray, and it's showing you, I'm showing you the stenosis here. My uncle, the neuroradiologist who used to terrorize me as a 15-year-old when I would visit him over vacation in his radiology office where he was the chair, would say, "Okay, Epstein, tell me about spinal stenosis." And I would have to say, "If you measure from the midvertebral body to the posterior interlaminar line, and that arrow is shorter than the measurement front to back of your vertebral body, most likely you have spinal stenosis on a 6-foot lateral film." Okay.
Interesting, never heard that before.
And here again is an MR image of a stenotic spinal canal. And remember, we didn't have MRIs until, the 80s, essentially. Before then, it was myograms. We didn't even have CAT scans yet until like 1976, where as a first-year resident neurosurgery, we were running around with Polaroids of CT images because we had only two machines in all of New York City. But here you can see, look at the MR, cord compressed opposite these levels, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, and 6, 7, straightened lordosis and stenosis. Okay, lordosis here, straightened. But you could see how, if you remove the vertebral bodies here, you can, with a straightened lordosis in some instances, get away with a posterior operation. Or if you do an anterior discectomy infusion with a lordotic graft above or below this, sometimes you can reverse the lordosis, put them into more lordosis, and get away with a posterior operation. So again, I'm going to show you just multiple examples of an MR cervical lordosis, really a hyperlordotic curvature. Look at the lordosis here, C2, C3, C4, 5, and 6. Look at the ventral compression. Look at the dorsal compression. You actually have shingling of the lamina. Instead of the lamina being sort of like this, you have the shingled lamina like that, right beneath it. But if you have a good lordotic curvature, as in both of these images, and in this third image of a myelogram CAT scan, okay, you remove the lamina from behind, that cord will migrate posteriorly like a rubber band, and then you confuse the patient because you have to maintain the lordosis. Here's another example. We've already gone through this previously in a previous lecture, C2, C3, C4. This is not disc disease. This is ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament going from C4, 5, all the way behind 5, C5, 6, behind 6, and all the way down to 6, 7. There may be sometimes accompanying disc with that, but if you take away all the bone back here, you may allow that cord to migrate posteriorly because you do have that good cervical lordotic curvature. And then this is an example of spondylosis where actually you have a high signal in the cord. But again, that good lordotic curvature is going to save you. Other examples here, again, curvature, good cervical lordosis, here seen on an MR, here seen on a CT scan. That's actually the same patient. Look in the CAT scan, see the shingled lamina. One, the leading edge of the lamina below is anterior to the level above, same thing over here. And it's just like, your Venetian blinds. One goes right in front of the other, and the leading edge inferiorly compresses your cord. Another example of shingled lamina here. This is C2, and this is C3, 4, and 5. And the lamina are shingled under each other here. C2, C3, here C4, 5, 6, and 7. They're all shingled underneath here. If you remove 5, 6, and 7 with a laminectomy, it allows your cord to come down, and then you can do a posterior fusion to preserve that anatomical alignment and get away with it. Here on an axial image, I'm showing you that you're seeing the shingled lamina. It means you see actually two lamina on the same axial image. And you're seeing it in this picture and maybe a little bit better in this picture. So you need to be able to read your own scans. Do not just rely on the radiologists. You need to know how to discern where the pathology is and how you're going to go about dealing with it. When you do the laminectomy, this is actually what you're doing. You're removing the lamina and the spinous process. You're preserving the facets, or you may be doing a medial facetectomy for immunotomy if you have spurs. You're going to have that patient when you do these operations in the prone position. Usually we would do nasotracheal awake intubations to make sure we're not flexing or extending the neck. You numb up the nose and the throat. You snake your way down with the nasotracheal tube and the fiber optic device. You intubate them then safely, and you get your baseline intraoperative monitoring. Motor evokes with them supine before you even turn them over. You can give them a short dose of propofol and get a motor evoke so you have a good preoperative baseline. You do not want to get your baseline after you are already positioned for surgery because you may have already compromise that patient. You may have already damaged that patient. Same thing for SEPs and your EMGs, obviously. EMGs, you're just going to get activity. So here's your figurative diagram of your laminectomy. Here's your laminectomy, and here's the bone that's been removed. Again, you've removed that bone. This is actually a patient with OPLL, and look at the mass of OPLL that's there, but the cord on this image could be sitting here, especially if you did an MRI. And here, this is a three-dimensional CT following a laminectomy where you just have C2 and C7 are still in place, but all the other bones have been removed. So your cord on the MRI is going to have migrated posteriorly into the space that you've created in that patient with a lordosis. Just some figurative images of you doing your cervical laminectomy. Here is C2, down here is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then here may be T1, downbiting curettes. You do your medial facetectomy for immunotomy, and you can use your downbiting curettes after you used a nerve hook and a Penfield elevator to make sure that you are not going in and inadvertently taking out the anterior motor nerve root. Again, that sometimes is not ensleeved in the dura, and you can mistake it for disc. So this is the dissection that you're going to want to be doing. And you can remove your spurs with your downbiting curettes by doing this. You can do your foraminotomies. You don't necessarily have to do full facetectomies. Obviously, that's going to further destabilize the patient. Too much of the time, surgeons are actually automatically taking out the facet joints, destabilizing the patient. But this is what it actually can look like. So you've done a laminectomy. This is actually the dura multiple levels, medial facetectomy for immunotomy. Here at one level, you're doing a more extensive foraminal dissection. Here is a nerve root exiting inferiorly and downward because, again, those arms are positioned down next to the body in that prone position. And here is a Penfield elevator very gently dissecting, exposing the axilla or armpit of that nerve root. And this is where you're going to then introduce your downbiting curettes, very small 2, 3 millimeter curettes. And again, every movement you do is away from the patient. You never use that curette towards the patient. That's how you're going to damage the cord inadvertently or get a CSF leak. Okay.
You see, you mentioned the anterior motor root sometimes is separate. Where would you see it in that picture?
Okay, well, you may see this. This could be just your isolated posterior sensory root that is in con you know, that is ensconced in the dura, has a dural sleeve, but you may see just ventral to it, like running here,
No.
something white, but the white would be coming down like that. That could be your anterior motor nerve root that is not intradural. but it can look very much like sometimes your disc fragments. That's why you have to listen to your EMGs very carefully, use that Penfield elevator, use your operating microscope to make sure you have exposed disc and you have not exposed or decided to take out that anterior motor root.
Okay, terrific.
Okay, but it can be very tricky to do that. Here's just an example where this is a preoperative MR. You've got a tight spinal canal. You've done a laminectomy here. Here's a post-op CT scan. That's a pre-op MR. Post-op CT, here's C2. You're taking out the lamina of 3, 4, 5, 6. And here's an intact lamina of 7. And here on the CAT scan, you're just seeing some air, et cetera. That's because this is where your operative wound was. You're not seeing any detail of the cord, though, are you? Okay. Here's your post-operative MR. Same patient, same time, early post-op. But here's your cord. Here's your cord pre-op compressed from front to back, you know, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. Kind of, they used to call it like the washboard. Not that I would know what that is, but anyway. But here is your cord now decompressed. You see CSF anteriorly and no CSF posteriorly here, no CSF anteriorly here. Now you see spinal fluid anteriorly. Now you see spinal fluid posteriorly. The cord has migrated. This is your posterior decompression. Okay, that's what you want to see.
If you take an image, that same image as your last image, MR image, 3 months later, is it different or does it look like that?
Okay, let me just get through. It should look like this or even better. Now, if you have had a very compressed spinal cord originally, and you have, let's say, just post-op edema in the cord, you may see more cord atrophy or myelomalacia, which would show you even more spinal fluid around the cord 3 months later, 6 months later, et cetera. Okay. The beauty also of doing your post-op studies is, let's say, you had one level where you had much more anterior compression. If there is on this post-op CT, much less MR, one level where you see residual significant anterior cord compression, be it a disc, a spur, an osteophyte, whatever, you could then go back and decompress that spinal cord anteriorly at that specific level. But that's why post-op studies are important. You want to know what you've done. You want to know what disease may be remaining behind. You want to make sure you don't have a post-operative hematoma, okay? And doing sequential studies is also important, especially, you know, in terms of your MRI scans, because if anything neurologically changes or gets worse, you need to study this. I see this again and again in looking at medical legal cases. It's almost like they're shoving everything under the rug. The last thing they want to do is a post-op study to document where the problem is. It might say you have to go back. It might say, you know, maybe you only did a laminectomy at two levels and you need to do another three or four levels to decompress the cord.
Well, when I look at the film and I go back to your measuring that the space there is in a spinal canal after you've decompressed them, it still looks compromised. If you look at the C6 level, there's a much wider area of CSF. It could be because of the cervical enlargement, but how do you look at that?
Well, very important on the MR, you have to look at all the medial lateral images. You have to, you know, this is just one sort of mid-sagittal image. You have to go from side to side. You also have to definitely look at the axial studies to
Okay.
document that you've adequately decompressed the cord. But you're absolutely right. What can often happen, especially at the mesenteric and caudate levels, you may find, hey, I've got residual compression. I've got to go back and do that or add that to the fusion and do a laminectomy, or maybe I have to go back anteriorly. But you need to look at the entire study, not just one set image.
So you need to know at the end of surgery, yes, I've decompressed them, but this person may still have some potential for problems. I mean, you need to come away with some conclusion.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
And post, I mean, there were lots of instances where, let's say, if intraoperatively, let's say, hypothetically, you did this operation and the patient had significant intraoperative changes.
Yeah.
But, you know, then they came back And you didn't think that you had to change your operative plan, which lots of times you have to do, raise the blood pressure, stop your distraction, et cetera. You keep the OR clean. You reverse the anesthetic, but keep them intubated in the OR. You call down to MR or CAT scan or both and say, I want to come down and get a stat study. You keep all the instrumentation in the OR ready to come back. You go get your stat study. You then can call back to the OR saying, oh, it's okay, we're adequately decompressed, or hey, we're going to come back, we need to do something more.
Okay, good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
So here's another example where look at the multi-level, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Especially at 6, 7, you see the high signal in the cord. This does not look good. This is your MR. It's not the best picture in the world. Here is a post-operative AP. C567 lateral mass screws have been placed. Here's your lateral view. Post-op screws are placed, etc. But most importantly, this is what you want to see in your post-op MRI. Okay. C2, C3, C4, 5, 6, 7. You've done a complete laminectomy. This is more like what we typically would see, Jim. We
Okay.
see more of a big bath of spinal fluid all around the cord. And that's what we're more happy looking at. And
Well,
again,
if you look at the other one, you've done the best you can do, but it's something you just have to keep track of. That's all.
right. And sequentially, the next week, the next month, et cetera, or the next few days, it
Yeah.
all depends on what that patient's neurological status is. The worst thing to do, it's like a complicated multi-level corpectomy patient that I presented. The worst thing to do is you do post-op studies, you do one operation or whatever it is, but you don't do any sequential follow-up studies, especially if that patient remains quadriplegic or has a significant deficit. You have to continue to do studies. Surveillance is critical. Decision-making is still critical. You can't just abandon the patient and just say, hey, it's everybody else's problem, I'm done.
Okay, real good.
And then posteriorly, you need to do a fusion to preserve that lordotic curvature because otherwise they'll become kyphotic and angulate forward. Lateral mass screws, you can use those C3, 4, 5, 6, C7, T1, and also at C2, it's going to be pedicle screws. So you can decide which of these you need. Sometimes when you're doing multi-level cervical laminectomy, you're going to fuse down to the T2 level to make sure you really stabilize that cervical thoracic junction. So in conclusion, when you are doing any of these cervical operations, look at your preoperative MR. I would say a preoperative CT scan is absolutely worth it. The CT scan can be smarter than you are. Make sure you learn how to read these studies yourself in addition to listening to your radiologist. I highly recommend conferring with your neuroradiologists. And I was very lucky, I still am. I have a neuroradiologist who's absolutely brilliant, and I would never operate without conferring with him and just bouncing back and forth. Do you see this? Do you see that? Do I need to repeat this? Do I need to get a better image of that? Is there a problem someplace else? Because you want to, based on these findings, do the right operation for that patient, and your patient will thank you.
Okay, that's terrific, Nancy. Really a tour de force of cervical spine surgery, pros and cons, just as you said, and really appreciate it. That's just an outstanding job.
The other thing we want to include here, I think, Jim, is just the references that people can look at.
Okay.
Neurological recovery after traumatic cervical spine injury. This is talking about when you reoperate on patients, the earlier the better, less than 24 hours. But if they have a significant deficit, you don't wait that period of time. It's like 0 to 24 hours, 6 or 12 hours. So here's in this study from Neurotrauma 2015, decompression and fusion, 8 to 24 hours. At 6 months, you're going to have better ASIA grade, AIS grades. That's like ASIA grades, essentially. So suggest that patients with spinal cord injury undergo surgical studies within and decompression within 8 hours after injury, and they're going to have better outcomes. Here's another study from Burke et al. In neurosurgery. Surgery within less than 12 hours, you're going to get relative improvement in these patients. Another study from Lancet 2021, early surgery, you're going to see greater recovery versus the late operations. And they said, quote, there was a steep decline in changes in total motor score with increasing time duration, the first 24 to 36 hours after the injury. And in Kui et al. 2021, early surgery less than 24 hours compared with late surgery, acute spinal cord injury, early surgery, greater recovery. Global Spine 2017, this is Wilson et al., and it included Failings, who was one of the promoters of Time is Spine. Early surgery supports improved neurological recovery among spinal cord injury patients undergoing early surgery. This is a systematic review. This was a Failing study in Global Spine 2024. Early surgery, again, overall moderate strength evidence, early surgery less than 24 for better recovery, very critical, except for those with longer. And here is Failing's article, Global Spine, Time is Spine. All spinal cord injuries, preclinical evidence suggests early limited secondary injury reduces damage to the neural tissues and improves function. Ultra early surgery, they couldn't make a comment on, but all of these factors are important in trying to get the best results.
Okay,
Okay.
terrific job. Really appreciate it. Really outstanding. Really,
Okay,
really. Okay.
good.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. Material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. At the end of this video, please fill out your evaluation of this program. And these are recorded sessions available free on snidigital.org. If you have questions, comments, or want to request CME credit, write to Ausman at snidigital.org. There are many ways to learn. The foundation supporting these programs has, as one of its journals, a 2D internet journal with Nancy Epstein as the editor-in-chief. It is SNI, also known as Surgical Neurology International. Its web address is sni.global. The other journal is a 3D live new video journal of neurosurgery and neuroscience, interactive with discussion. It's SNI Digital Innovations in Learning, and the web address is snidigital.org. The information on both of these journals is free on the internet to everyone everywhere, 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It's been published for 14 years. It's the third most widely read 2D journal in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is now seen in 106 countries in 5 months. It's a new 3D video journal. The goal of the foundation is to help people throughout the world. Also, it has a medical news network dedicated to bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. These programs are sponsored by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. They're copyrighted in 2024. All rights are reserved. Thank you for watching the program. We hope you've enjoyed it.